Hello, this is Chris Nelson for evolveconsciousness.org. Today is going to be a presentation on metaphysics, language, and reality. And this is a basic introductory material for the trivium. There are about 20 or so images. I've been working on these for the past few months. The images were mostly developed from reading the Trivium book by Sister Miriam Joseph. Apart from that, I guess there is not much to say, so I will just begin with image one, which is the base of the Trivium and the Quadrivium, the base of the seven liberal arts. The seven liberal arts has to do with reality in our mind and matter, the two most fundamental parts that we recognize in reality, our consciousness and existence itself. So the importance of the seven liberal arts is to get to action, to do something in the world with what we know. Action begins in an agent. We are causal agents and we can create actions. And the action ends in an agent. That means the effects of the action come back as input into other agents in order for us to causally create more output actions, and it reciprocally feeds back. That's how the web of reality of our interaction in our behavior and our actions functions. I have an infographic on that, on natural law causal agents. So on the left, there's the trivium, which represents 3, and the quadrivium on the right, which represents 4. So the quadrivium comes after the trivium, because you need to know how to think first before you study existence and reality more accurately. So the trivium is the arts of the mind, arts of language. It deals with letter symbols. The quadrivium is the arts of matter, and of quantity and extension. And it deals with number symbols. So the letter symbols is how we communicate about reality, how we attribute meaning, how we give meaning, appropriate meaning. And we can't really communicate with numbers, those are too basic, but reality is composed of numbers. So it's two different ways of looking at it, but we first need to communicate about reality before we can get into the more abstract perceptual aspects of reality, which is more focused on numbers. And Pythagoras went into that, and many other philosophers. But the most important part is learning how to think, the art of the mind, and that's where logic comes in, as the art of thinking. Before logic, you have to input things, and that's where the art of inventing and combining symbols. We invent symbols, arbitrary symbols that we then attribute to specific meanings, which are not arbitrary. Then the symbol is imbued with a meaning, and we can combine symbols to give greater complexity and directedness of our communicability towards others. So if we only use a few symbols, we can't communicate much, but as we combine symbols and create greater complexity, we can communicate more about reality. So logic comes afterwards, and this is the central part of the trivium, which I've gone into in the other five-part article series called Language and Reality. It's the art of thinking. Logic is the most important for everything. You have the input and you have the output. And without the processing, all you have is stimulus and response, grammar to rhetoric. Logic is the most important. And then finally, after you figure things out and you process it and you think correctly, then you can finally use the art of communicating, which is rhetoric, in order to output things in a logically coherent, cohesive manner that makes sense when you're trying to represent reality through symbols that we use to communicate. So the trivium, when you use grammar, logic, rhetoric, the goal is all about thinking. and it produces, and it's the capacities that allow us to read, write, speak, and listen. So just briefly, on the right side, the quadrivium has to do with matter, quantity, extension, number, symbols. Arithmetic is basic number. Geometry is number in space. Music is number in time and space, so it's time and motion. And astronomy is music is number in time, and then astronomy is number in time and space. Music is just the numbers as they move. You have to have time change, and then you can hear the different notes as they're played. If you had no time, you wouldn't hear any notes. There needs to be motion. Similar with astronomy, if you don't have motion, all you have is an object in space, and that's geometry. Geometry is still, it doesn't move. But when you have planets, and they move in space, well, that's astronomy. So on the one side you have a theory of number, and on the other side you have a theory of space. The number is just abstract numbers, so everything with number, arithmetic, algebra, calculus, mathematics, other things. And then in the theory of space you have geometry and trigonometry, which use mathematics in order to calculate spatial areas. And these two have to do with number, they're of matter and spirit. The theory of number leads to the application of number. The theory of space leads to the applications of space. And these applications deal with quantity and extension, and they're of matter only. So application of number, if music, physics, chemistry, deals all with matter. Music, you need a musical instrument to play with it. You can create it with your vocal cords, but that's still in matter. Numbers are abstract. Then we can apply them in reality. The same thing for space. Trigonometry, geometry. And when we apply continuous quantity in space, then we get to astronomy and architecture and creating the geometry into three-dimensional shapes to live in. And we have geography, and then we have engineering, other aspects of creating. Alright, so we'll move on to image 2. Now we're getting into language and reality. So communication is about common ground understanding, coming to terms, a oneness in truth of reality. You communicate symbols about reality. So we're not going to communicate in order to remain in conflict, in order to remain on different pages, on different levels of understanding. No. When we communicate, we want to get a common ground understanding. We want to get on the same page. We want to come to terms. We want to have a oneness of understanding the truth of reality. That's why you have to often define your terms, because you can say one word and you mean one thing, and someone hears the word and they understand something else, and then semantic misunderstandings develop. This is why an understanding of language and logic is very important in order to communicate properly, because these semantic misunderstandings happen frequently in conversations where people don't even end up talking about the same thing, and it goes on for hours, and they don't even realize that the problem is in the language. So language and reality is where we're dealing with metaphysics or ontology itself, and this is the science of being. Anything that's being, that's what metaphysics is. It's anything that's being. And we'll get more into that later. So it's a thing as it exists in reality. Everything exists. So just a hint at what's coming. You have substance and you have non-substance, which is an accident. You have a substance, which is, say, my remote controller or myself. And then you have accidents or non-substances, and that would be the color white, which are things that happen to be there that aren't necessary, that aren't essential. So the cup could be white, it could be gray, it could be black, it could be green. The color isn't essential. So all these things exist. The color exists. It's not a thing that exists in itself. Anyways, we're going to be getting into that more after. So when we get from metaphysics, we're going to break into the three aspects of consciousness again, which are grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So in the grammar side, we have the thing as it is symbolized. You recall back in the first image, we had grammar, which is symbols. Logic was thinking, and rhetoric was communication. So in grammar, it's the thing as it is symbolized when we're looking at things as they exist. So in grammar, the thing as it exists is, as it is symbolized, something is perceived. That's the grammar. Next is the thing as it is known. We learn about it, and that's the logic, which is the art of arts, and that's what directs all our action, which is the point of the seven liberal arts. That's why logic is central to everything, because it's what directs our actions. It's the reasoning for why we do things. And logic is the master art in Sister Miriam Joseph's terms, but I say rhetoric is the master art in Sister Miriam Joseph's words, but I say logic is the master art. Logic is the art of arts. Logic is everything. Of course, you need rhetoric. You need to output, because if you know things and you don't act on them, then you know nothing, essentially, and it's worthless knowledge. Like I said, stimulus and response without the central part of processing your information, all you are is a robot. I've explained this in other articles relating with language and reality. So the third part is the thing as it is communicate, we communicate it. After something is perceived, we learn about it, then we communicate it. It's a thing as it is symbolized, the thing as it is known, and then the thing as it is communicated. But to know something, you need logic. Then we get to the norms. The norms of grammar are correctness. You need to have your correct input, or else your processing and your output will be skewed. I would say proportionally related, directly related to the correctness or incorrectness of your input. If you're inputting garbage, you will output garbage. If you are inputting quality, you will output quality. So logic has to do with truth and correct thinking, the conformity of thought with reality. That's aligning our thoughts with reality, our perceptions with reality, uniting thoughts with reality, harmonizing thoughts with reality, bringing our thoughts and our perceptions into equilibrium with reality so that we're not in contradiction with reality. That's what logic is all about. So again, I'm always going to stress the importance of logic, because that's where you sink or swim. That's where the processing is. You got to input correctly. But if you don't process it correctly, you could have all the best information in the world, and you're not going to process it correctly, and then you're not going to output properly into the world in the wisdom of right action. So with rhetoric, the norm is considered effectiveness, and this is what I would consider part of this focus of effectiveness of rhetoric I explained in the part 4 of the Language and Reality article series entitled Dark, Negative, and Limited Trivium, in which I discussed why the effectiveness is, as a focus, overrides the supremacy and the mastery of logic in order to direct our actions. When you focus more on the effectiveness of the reception of your message or other qualities, then you lose sight of the primary, most important capital, which is truth. So, the material and function of grammar is phonetics, where we combine sounds. That's the way sounds sound. Spelling is the combination of letters, which are symbols to represent those sounds. And the grammar is the combination of words from those letters and all the other symbols. That's the grammar. Logic is where we combine the concepts. And the rhetoric is where we combine the sentences from the concepts and the grammar in order to output them and communicate to ourselves and others about reality. Next up is image number 3. So we're continuing from language and reality. So in language, there's a nature and a function of language. It's a system of symbols for the expression of consciousness, thoughts, emotions, and volition, will, or action. And if you're familiar with my other work, in regards to the circle of life, what I term the circle of life, which has to do with consciousness, causality, and the trivium, I've already related how grammar, logic, and rhetoric relates to thought, emotion, and action in the way we live our lives. They're not specifically correlated directly, but in the wheel of the circle of life that I've constructed, one thing follows from the other, and it works beautifully. So if you're not familiar with that, check into the circle of life presentation infographic that I did. So from these aspects of consciousness, these expressions of consciousness, we're able to create a communication of ideas. From language, we're able to communicate ideas because we create a system of symbols for the expression of our consciousness to express reality and ourselves in reality. So when we communicate ideas, there we can do an imitation, an artificial likeness. So we can create a painting, we can draw a sketch, take a photograph, make a cartoon, create a statue, make a gesture. These are representations of something in reality. An imitation, artificial likeness, it's an image. But it's not an image in our mind, it's actually an image in reality, but it imitates something that really does exist as itself. You know, a statue is an imitation of a man. It's not a man itself. A painting isn't a landscape. The landscape itself is the landscape in nature. A painting is just a painting of a landscape. Now, apart from the bare imitation, artificial likeness, we actually have symbols which are an arbitrary, sensible sign with an imposed meaning that we give it. So it's a sensible sign because it's a sign that we use our senses in order to detect. I suppose I'll make possibly an error, but sensible, you can even use auditory. So a symbol that we speak that has a certain phonetics, that's a symbol, but it's sensible. It's a sensible sign because we can hear it. Something that we can see is also sensible. The letter S, YMBOL, symbol, that word, the letters, those six letters are sensible signs. The six letters together is another sensible sign. It's symbols added up together. The combining of symbols, and then we impose a meaning upon it. We imbue those symbols with a meaning. You could look at a circle with a dot. Like, oh, that's the sun or the earth or with the cross. There's all symbols that we can recognize sensibly with our senses, and we can recognize meaning from it. So we have meaning from nature and a meaning from convention. There's an inherent meaning in things from nature, and then there's a conventional meaning that we impose and that can change over time as people decide to change the meaning of something in reality and the symbol, the communicated symbol that represents it. You have common symbols and special symbols. So the common symbols would be our language that we use to communicate every day. And then there's special symbols, such as specialists use in their specific field, chemistry, physics, mathematics, symbols that most people wouldn't recognize because they're only for special case communications about those fields. Whereas common symbols, well, everyone who uses that common base understands what it is, because it's the commonality they use. And that's part of the common ground understanding of communication. You want to use languages that people understand, or else you're essentially encrypting information in reality, which I've gone into in part 3 of the Language and Reality series. How we encrypt reality and how language essentially is, it's a mode to decrypt reality and communicate about it, but it's also an encryption, because if you know a language and someone else doesn't, then two people can communicate in a language and someone else won't know what they're talking about. So a language is a way to encrypt reality in a sense, even though it's used, created, devised in order to facilitate communication about reality in order for us to be on a common page of understanding. But if someone else is excluded from that common page of understanding, then reality becomes encrypted for them with reference to us communicating about it. So symbols all reference something that exists or has existed in fact or fiction. Whether we create it in our mind, there's a word for it, there's a symbol for it, we draw something, there's always a representation for something that has existed or is existing now, or will exist, in fact or fiction, there's always a symbol for it. That's how we communicate about everything, that's how we see things, that's how we hear things, it's all a symbolic representation. Because a sound could mean anything. You could say red, or red means a color, but I could invent a new language and say and use the word red, that phonetics, and it would mean water. It could mean anything. That the symbols are arbitrary, sensible signs, but we impose meaning. That's when we imbue the meaning onto them. And once you give it a meaning, if you're going to change the meaning, then you're going to create confusion. And there'll be ignorance. And then people will desire to control because they won't understand reality. So when you create a reference to reality through a symbol, it should stay that way and not be altered through the conventions of society as it progresses in time in order to change and alter meanings. Next image, image number 4, follows from the previous one. So from symbol, we go down, then there's a dotted arrow. Now, from symbol, we're going specifically into word. So spoken language is the original and fundamental system of symbols for which all other signs are merely substituted. As we go back to image 2, mentioned in the material and function of language, for grammar we have phonetics, which is the combining of sounds. And then we get to spelling and then to grammar, from sounds to letters to words. And that's what I had to, on image number 4 here. Spoken language is the original and fundamental system of symbols in which all others later come. So the word is a symbol. It's a metaphysical conceptualization for philosophical understanding. So in the conceptual understanding, these are the phantasms, images, and concepts in our mind. There's two types of symbols, one's of matter, and there's symbols of form. The of matter is the sensible sign. And, two parts to symbol, word and symbol. Symbols have form and they have matter. The matter part is the sensible sign, and the form part is the imposed meaning. So matter, it's physical, it's around us, it's sensible. We can see it. It's detectable. It's the first intrinsic and purely potential principle of a corporeal essence. So corporeal essence is just something that exists in reality. Now the form takes that pure potential matter that can be anything, and it arranges the components, it coordinates them into a specific shape. That's the imposed meaning, because you can have matter. Matter is everywhere in our reality. Not all matter looks the same. It has a certain chemical structure or atomic structure, sorry. So you can have steel, which is made up of stuff. You can have just iron. You can have copper. You can have wood. So there's different types of matter, and they're all made up of different things, but you can have a chair that's made up of wood or made up of a certain type of metal. So the matter doesn't matter in what creates. The matter does matter to create the form, but the type of matter doesn't. It's the form that gives it the shape. Anyways, there's more on that coming. Just wanted to briefly explain it. So the form is the first intrinsic and actual principle of a corporeal essence. The matter is the potential to be something once it has a form, and the form is the actual. We'll be getting more into the potential and actual part of matter and form. So matter, the word type is spoken and written. And for spoken, the matter of spoken is sound. That's how that's a sensible sign of the matter. When it's spoken, it's through sound, and that's the study of phonetics. When the symbol is the written type, then it's a notation of matter as a sensible sign, and that's spelling, the study of spelling. And form is everything. The word type is everything, spoken, written, everything. There's always a form. The form is what gives meaning to all the words, all the sensible signs we create. And the form is the study of semantics. That's why you have semantic misunderstandings when person A uses a specific term and it has a specific meaning in a form. the person B doesn't interpret, doesn't receive that meaning and form, and they understood something else. And now the path diverges. Now they're on two separate paths. They're not on the common ground. They're not on the same page. They're not on the same level. Now things diverge. And if you keep progressing that way, which is how everyone progresses usually in a conversation in our society, then things diverge. You get confusion. You get conflicts. Things do not turn out right because people don't understand language and reality. I understood this aspect of semantic misunderstandings even before I knew of the term trivium, which I learned of in 2010, because I was already using grammar and logic and rhetoric, even though I didn't know of it as the trivium, and I didn't study grammar, but I did study logic, and I understood these problems in communication that can arise, known as semantic misunderstandings. So that's why it's important to have a proper, accurate definition of a word, which can be found in etymology, and we can deobfuscate and decloud the conventional meaning and go back to the original meaning that the word was created to mean, rather than the changes as have been applied through the conventions of society over time. So, your symbol is of matter and of form. There's matter and form. In the matter side, that's where we're going to relate it to an individual specific thing, because it's corporeal essence. It's the potential of the corporeal essence, and that's the individual specifics. Now, on the other side, we have the essence and nature, which relates to form, because the essence and nature is what will provide, in this model, it'll provide the information for the potential matter to organize, coordinate its components, and form the shape that it's supposed to take. So, a side note, if you know about Rupert Sheldrake, this relates to the morphogenetic field, whereby the morphogenetic field informs the matter that is shaped for specific beings, for specific entities, for specific animals. So different animals have different morphogenetic fields, they have different forms, they have different blueprints that they ascribe to, and that they receive their information in order for basic programmed functionality for existence. Just survival and mechanistic operations, those things that we don't necessarily learn. So that's the essence and nature of the form, which informs the matter. The matter is informed by the form, and the form informs the matter. So, below the individual and specific essence and nature, we can see that the individual and the specific is an existing being. This is where we can apply the law of identity with things that exist in reality, and we can see the difference in the multiplicity, the variability, and the diversity of existence, reality, and universe. From the form side, essence and nature, this is what makes a being what it is. This is the kind and class, the likeness. So you have all humans. That's our species. That's where the essence and nature, the form, comes from, the morphogenetic blueprint, in order for us to all look alike. That's our likeness, our kind, our class. And as we apply more differentia, going towards the existing being, that's when more differences apply. So you get the basic blueprint of a human, but then more differences apply. So you have different races, you have different, even within the different races, there's different tribal specificity, where there's been differences through changes in location and geography. Even though it's technically one of the major races, there's still differentia within the subspecies. So that's where you have the more and more variability, the more diversity, the more multiplicity is from that differentia being applied in greater degrees from the form, the essence, and nature towards the individual specific matter of the existing being, that thing which is itself and not another, that makes it different from others. So we have these processes, which are going to be related more later. We have matter, which goes to the individual, which is things that exist. We have form, which is the essence, and kind and class and likeness. We have induction and deduction logic, which will be explained a bit more after this. But we have the apophatic, negation, deduction, the separating, the division. And that's how we arrive at the difference in the law of identity, is through looking at the differentia, we can deduce what things are in the separation, in the division of the universe, everything combined and turned into one. There's separation, there's division, and we can look through the negative by removing things, the apophatic path, and we can deduce the law of identity, we can deduce essences, and differences, and sameness. So that's going from the kind and class. We apply the apophatic, negative, deduction, separation, division to go through the differentia and arrive at the existing being, the law of identity, the difference. And conversely, if we start from existing being, we can get to the kind, class, likeness through induction. And that's cataphatic, and that's an affirmation of what is, to induct and join and unite what is in order to formulate generalized concepts about reality. That's why there's the bigger blue arrows, which is existing being. Well, you get there from the cataphatic affirmation and the kind, class, and likeness. You get there from... So the existing being, law of identity, difference, you use cataphatic affirmation, induction, joining, unity to get to the general concept of kind, class, likeness, to understand that. And the inverse is true for the other side. So where you have your kind, class, likeness, you're going to use apophatic, negation, deduction, separation, division in order to arrive at more differences and the existing beings, the identifiable things that exist in reality. So further, matter, individual, specific, existing thing, that's the individual. And on the other side, you have species, and then further, genus. And that's how we look at things. We have me, a particular individual, then you have the species, which is man, then you have the genus, animal, whatever, and the species genus is a repetitive loop. You can go from specific to general, and then your general can become your specific, and then you find another general to become the new general, or you go downwards, and it might be confusing. But such a parent-child relationship, if you're aware of programming, you can look into it. Genus is the parent, species is the child, and then species becomes the parent for the individual particular, which then becomes the child. So the genus is the species with the common essence, and the species is the individuals with the common essence. So the genus is the specific general, species general loop, which I just explained. And if you go more towards the aggregate, if you go more towards the particular from the species, then you have numerous individuals, then you can form aggregate groups of individuals. So you have political parties. You know, they're not a species. You can't go from an individual to a political party species. It's not a human being. It's not a new species. It's not a genus. It's not an animal. It's an aggregate grouping of individuals. And they can be, you can have a grouping of different species. You can have humans and birds and cats and a bunch of different things, and that'll be an aggregate grouping of individuals. So in the individual, from going from Khan class likeness to the existing being, you have more differentia, so you have more definition, you have more characteristics, and more difference. When you're going up in the levels towards the more likeness, the more general kind and class, you have less definition, less characteristics, and things are more similar. So that was probably a lot of information, but if you read the book by Sister Miriam Joseph, this image will probably help you a lot. And if you don't read it, I'm not sure how much my explanations themselves will provide clarity required. But if you read the book, I'm sure it'll make a lot more sense. But in an infographic way like this, it might be difficult in my explanation. It works better if you explain it yourself and you understand the material yourself. And this is more of a reference to remind you of the complexity of how these things work. Because if you just read it yourself, it's hard to come up with this understanding. That's why I visualized what I was reading, and I created these flowcharts, these infographics, for people to more easily understand this material, because it can be quite complex to understand. So I would recommend that you are familiar with the content so that you can understand more clearly what I'm talking about. Because I'm not going into big elaborate explanations for all these things. That's why there are books for such tasks. So please go learn more. Image number 5. Creating symbols from reality. This is about generating a concept. We're going to be getting more into what particulars and universals are. But to start off, we've already been talking about it in the previous image when we went from matter, the individual specific existing thing, to essence and nature of the form, which is kind, class, and likeness. This is the same thing. The particular is the individual specific, which we can relate to of matter. And then when we look at the universal, that's the of form, which is where we find the essence. So when we process particulars, we're looking at the real object, the primary substance, the material. It's limited to locality as a place and time. When you're processing universals, though, it's a concept. It's not something that necessarily actually exists as a real object that concretely exists in reality. These are conceptual things like the color green or an animal. An animal doesn't exist itself. It's a classification for things that exist in reality that are known as animals under that genus. Animals. But animal, there is no thing that is an animal. It doesn't exist itself. So that's a concept. It's knowledge of the essence. The animal is the essence that we're all the same. All the animals are the same because we're all animals. That's our essence. It's part of our essence. It's part of our definition. And it's immaterial. Like I said, it doesn't exist in itself. It can't exist. An animal can't exist as an animal. It has to exist through a human that is an animal. A cat that is an animal. And these things are non-local, they're non-temporal, they're just in your mind. You can conceptualize animality any place, any time. It's not dependent upon that. It doesn't exist in time and space. So the way we find these particulars and universals and process them is through our senses. And I have an article on the senses and how we need to trust those more than we do technology. Technology can show us a lot of things, yes, but if you're using technology to override what your senses are showing you, then you're failing miserably in your ability to perceive, conceive, understand, and navigate reality. When your technology overrides your senses, oh, plants are animals, didn't you know? Why? Oh, because we got technology now that can show us that that plants sense in many, many different ways. 15, 20, 25 senses So now all of a sudden, plants are animals. Everything else that we see with our eyes, that they have eyes, that they have ears, that they have mouths, they have tongues, they have teeth, they have lungs, they have hearts, they have brains. You know, they're animals like us, but no, now there's humans, and there's plants and animals. Plants and animals are the same, and then there's humans. So this is how retarded people become when they don't want to face reality and the truth. And yes, I did say retarded, because you are idiotic retards when you believe that plants are animals. You need to go connect to reality. Anyways, that's a side topic. I just wanted to mention the importance of senses in understanding reality and generating concepts over technology. Same thing with the quantum world. I don't give a shit about any of the quantum world. I understand quantum reality better than everybody in the New Age movement, and better than most of these pseudo-scientists who got these PhDs and pretend they're scientists but don't even understand what the experiment shows. You do not live in the quantum world. I do not live in the quantum world. Why are idiots projecting blind correspondences, blind as above, so below, from the quantum world to our manifested reality without understanding the principle of emergent properties and the system, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts? People just, oh yeah, we're just quantum energy. Anyways, people do not understand how to process reality properly, because they're not using their senses, they're not using their minds, they're not thinking. They read what other people say, and then they gobble it up as reality, because it allows them to reinforce their preconceptions about reality and sustain the attachment and maintenance of that falsity. And they don't need to change anything, because they can just keep believing the same bullshit. So quantum world, I don't really care. Plants feel, congratulations, they're not animals. Move along. Get connected to reality. So our senses, first they start externally. We have our five senses. There's an object present in reality. And then we develop a perceptual image. This is the most vivid sense apprehension, but it's the less clear in knowledge. There's hardly any knowledge when we just perceive things. We can perceive a color, perceive a shape, perceive certain things. That's the most vivid. It's right in our senses. Then we bring that perceptual image from the objects that are present in reality. We bring that perceptual image. Now it's internal. We bring it into our imagination. We got an image in our imagination. And that's a phantasm. It's a mental image of that object. Now with this mental image, we can develop more knowledge. We can correlate it with other things in our comprehension of reality, and we can create correspondences and connections and interlink patterns. But in this image of the mind, it's less vivid. It's not right in front of our eyes where we can continue to get details and specifics and go into more detail of the pixels we see in front of us. It's less vivid. But because we can manipulate it in our mind, we can derive more knowledge from it. So the imagination is really powerful. This is what we use the most. Apart from the imagination, there's other internal senses, which Sister Mary and Joseph listed as instinct, common sense, and sensuous memory. And sensuous memory would be the memory of things of our senses. We recall smells, sights, not memory of knowledge and abstract concepts. That's for later. So the on the right side of infographic number 5, another way to express how we process reality. We have a particular extant objects in reality. Then we have our sense stimulus. That's the first phase of our consciousness, where it's a stimulus response. If we don't take it further, it's just input, output. Our second step is the percept, where from our sense stimulus experiences, we're going to connect those sense experiences, and we're going to form perceptions of reality from those experiences and senses. Different senses coming together is going to form a certain perception of reality, and that's going to become part of our memory. So the percept deals more with memory. And the sense stimulus is just basic input for you to output. And then your percept is you create a reference between many senses and you create a perception of reality in your memory. And the third phase is conceptual. That's where you connect percept instances and memory. So the perceptions you previously created in the second phase, where you connected experiences, those connected experiences that create memories, you can further connect those different memories, those different perceptual instances of reality into abstract ideas, concepts about reality. And this is how we start from the particular extant object in reality, and we're going towards the universal, the abstract ideas. The universals are known this way. We're abstractly integrating concepts and abstractions from abstractions. So we're taking the concepts we previously integrated, the previous abstract ideas, integrating them together, and we're taking those abstract conceptions and we're going to abstract even more from those abstractions to get even more abstract generalities about reality and connect things even more. All right, next image up is number 6, Creating Symbols from Reality, Part 2. More flowcharts on how we generate a concept. On the left, we have starting with reality and nature, which is our raw material for input. Then we get to our senses. From our senses, as we saw in the previous infographic, get to our imagination, our internal senses, from our external senses, from the imagination and intellect, we're able to abstract the commonality of similar objects that exist in reality, which is our raw material for input. These abstractions of commonality will lead us to the essence of things. The essence is the form, as we saw in previous infographic. So from the essence, we get the general universal concept, which contains the form. These are from reality and from the mind. There's an objective norm in reality. There's something that exists in reality. Then in the mind, there's a subjective arbitrary symbol. From the arbitrary symbol and the objective norm in reality, we're trying to obtain truth. That's why we arrive at the general universal concept, which is represented through mind and reality. That's why on infographic number 2, we had logic, and we had the norm of logic was the conformity of thought with reality. Now coming back to infographic number 6, that's what we're about. We're about thought and reality, mind and reality. We need to join them, make them congruent, cohesive, integrated, united, harmonized, not opposed, not disunited, not disintegrated. So the objective norm in reality needs to align with the arbitrary symbol that we subjectively appropriate. That's why understanding the meaning of words is important. Because that's where the truth is about reality, is in the meaning of the word. And if anyone wants to use a word and create a new meaning for it, well, that creates confusion, and it leads us away from truth of understanding our reality. On the right side, a more basic description. First, you got your data. Then it goes into senses. You could either say that's 5 pieces of data into one sense, or that's 1 piece of data into 5 senses, or 1 piece of data representing 1 sense. It doesn't matter, I just put 5 because it's, you know, 5 senses, it fits. From our senses, we get to our perceptions, and that's where we start. So the data, the senses, that's automatic. I've explained this in the last Language and Reality series. Part 5 on logic, that the data input of the senses is the most easiest thing we can do. All we do is just look. All we do is just receive. We hear a sound, we see something, see a ball rolling, see something move. That's just our senses. That is where things start for us, but it's not where it starts for us to understand. Those are just perceptions of reality. We don't derive much understanding from that. Understanding comes from logic and processing reality. So our perceptions start is where we have knowledge on the observations from reality. We sense and we perceive. That's where the things start. That's where the grammar starts. Next, we get to the logic, the induction, not the deduction, because that comes later to verify our concepts, but the induction part in order to create and generate the general universal concepts. So that's the method. First we have the start, then we have the method. That's the abstractions from the grounded measurable relationships in concretes, in the potential of matter that exists. And from that induction, we integrate our perceptions into conceptions. And that's why you need logic. Perception to conception does not occur without logic. So you would never have any conceptions without logic. All you would have would be perceptions. And your understanding of reality would be immensely limited. It would be more simplified, absolutely. We'd live in simplicity. Can't say it's wrong. I'm not sure I would desire that, given the gifts of higher order consciousness and the capacity to think, but it'd be less evil, that's for sure. So when we integrate into our concepts, into conceptions from logic, that's the form. The method was to create the conceptions. The form of the conception is what results. That's the shape that we result from our input of perceptions, the knowledge of observations and reality, the abstract measurable relationships from that grounded information, and then those relationships get formulated into conceptions. We use abstractions to identify aspects of reality. So reality induces conceptions, which are abstractions, and then we can use those abstractions to further identify and deduce aspects of reality. Logic is powerful. It's the most important. Image number 7, part 3 of creating symbols from reality, generating a concept. So these three infographics were just different flowcharts, different ways of representing how we create symbols from reality. So tying to infographic number 5, which was at the top, processing particulars and processing universals, here we get a similar correspondence. We have our language symbols, and there's 4 types. One is symbolized by individuals, which is more with processing particulars. And in the language symbols, the other side symbolizes essence, which is the general and universal. So the symbols aren't the particular, they aren't the universal, but they're symbols for the individual particular and symbols for the general essence. We need these symbols to communicate about these things in reality. So the individual can be a proper name, the essence can be a common name. An individual is a particular empirical description or experience. It's an object, place, time, something that experiences in reality as the thing itself. And the essence is the general universal description, general categories for reference, so the things that things belong to. Human, cat, dog, you know, belong to the general of animal, the genus. So we have our natural object, which is where we're inside of it, where the form is, where the universal is. That's where we find our substance, the essence, the nature, the form, species and genera. These are all similar but distinct aspects. Substance, essence, nature, form, species, genera. They're all Yeah, they're similar, but they're distinct. Anyways, look into those yourself if you want to know the specific differences. And these are symbolized by the common name. That's the general, not the proper name, not the specific things, not the particular things in reality. And the common name, the general universal, this substance and essence and form, is what leads us to the definition to express the knowledge of a concept of that universal general. So when we have symbolized by common name, on the right we have common names. Common names are a simple concept, such as the natural species, a human being. And then we have, from that simple concept, we can develop other common names. We can construct composite concepts, such as a lawyer or athlete. That's not a being in itself. It's a composite concept. We're taking a human being and a profession, a doing, a task, and then we're attributing it this new symbol, a common name called lawyer, athlete. So these constructs, they add definition to the natural species through the accidents, such as a specific action that you take, such as law or hockey or basketball, football. Those are accidental qualities to the natural species. You don't have to have that. And that's another way we can differentiate particulars and individuals through these composite concepts that add definition to our reality, add differentia, make things more different. Image number 8. Alright, I believe this is the last part, yeah. Number 4, part 4 of creating symbols from reality, generating a concept. Again, these are just flowcharts on understanding how we go from reality to generating an understanding of reality. Nature provides the substance that already exists. From these substances that already exist, we can create artificial objects. And artificial is from It's an art from our arms, because we create with our hands, our arms. And this is aesthetics, to represent the good in the things we create visually. That's where the beauty comes from. And these are things, the artificial objects are fashioned by man. They come from substances that exist already inherently in nature. And we change them, we alter them. These artificial objects have two essences. Again, going back to, I think, infographic 4, image number 4, we got the matter and the form. So now we're tying back to that. We got nature, substance, things that exist, and we create things from those things that exist. The things that we create, there's two aspects to them. Even the things that already existed, there's two aspects to them. But the things we create, such as a chair, a table, or a toy, well, that's the form that informs the matter. And the matter is wood, metal, or plastic. But it'll create the chair, table, or toy that'll be the same. It'll just be the matter that's informed by the form that creates, that shapes, and coordinates the components of the wood, of the metal, of the plastic into making it the specific shape that it becomes. That's why in the form is where you find the definition. Because the chair is the definition of the thing. The table, the toy, what it does, is where you'll find the definition. You're not going to find it in the wood or the metal or the plastic of that chair, table, or toy. That's not where the definition is. That was the potential to become the actual chair, table, toy. That's why before it was matter as the first, what is it? One second. First, intrinsic and purely potential principle of a corporeal essence versus, as opposed to the form, which is the first intrinsic and actual principle of a corporeal essence. The form is actual, the matter is potential. The matter has the potential to become the many different forms that exist. So in the middle flowchart, we have reality. From reality, we abstract images, ideas, and concepts, and then we classify them into symbols and words. This is the most basic one. These three bubbles in this flowchart is as simple as it gets. Reality to images, ideas, and concepts, and then we classify them into symbols and words in order to express those images from our mind to other people. Because if you got reality, you induce it and you form concepts, well, okay, that's all inside of you and you have concepts, ideas, and images. But if you're not going to classify them and find a way to express those images and create symbols and words, well, then it just ends up staying inside of you. No one, you don't share with anyone, and no one else is able to share with you, so everyone is just living in ignorance. And on the left side, from symbol, we get the two major classifications of particular and general, or particular and universal. Then we get down to the four kinds. This is where we get more into Aristotle's work. So there's the four kinds, which are the pre-predicamente. And then there's, after the four kinds, you get into the 10 categories, which are coming up. And that's the actual predicamente. And then there's additional 3+ subcategories, 10+, 15+, 1,000,000+, who cares? These are subcategories, additional categories, which were of lesser importance. And Aristotle termed these the post-predicamente, or predicamente. So we're going to get into the four kinds and the 10 categories of being. So we've already discussed, partially, the particular and the universal. Image number 9. This is an infographic about the 10 categories of being. Being is what exists. This is the core of metaphysics. If we go back to infographic 2, language and reality, it's all about describing reality, which is what language is for. And reality is the thing as it exists, and that's the purpose of metaphysics or ontology, which is the science of being, the science of things that exist. So, from being, we have the particular and the universal, and we have four pre-predicamente, which I'll explain later, after the 10 categories. So even though in the infographic 8, we had symbol, particular, universal, four kinds, 10 categories, because that's the way it actually goes, because you have the particular accident, the particular substance, and then you have the universal accident and the universal substance. But since I haven't gone into substances and accidents yet, I'll cover the 10 categories and then go back to the pre-predicamenta to show the four kinds and how they apply to the primary parts of the 10 categories of being, which are substance and non-substance. So from being, things that exist,